rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back to another beautiful week. Tom Hartman here with you. Beautiful day. It certainly is here in Portland, Oregon. I suspect it is for much of the country. Down in the southeast, of course, they're being hammered by, is it Hurricane Dennis now? It is the, what is the next? I don't know. My computer's not telling me the date for some reason. Something's wrong here. Anyhow, it's the 11th of July. There you go. Welcome back. July 11th. And what is the missing link in terms of the hurricane coverage? Why aren't we getting the whole story? What's the deal with the hurricane coverage? Well, the whole story. And boy, do we have a conspiracy update for you conspiracy fans today. We'll probably get into that in our second hour of our program. Something going on in the UK at the exact same moment the bombings were going on. I'll tell you about it later, but you're not going to believe it. It's astounding. I don't know how to describe it. Yeah, just good old-fashioned astounding. Today, July 11th, is World Population Day. And in my opinion, this is one of the most undiscussed, underreported, and probably most important issues in the world. I mean, and this has to do with why we're being whacked with a hurricane. The first Category 4 hurricane to come on shore, although I guess it's down to Category 3 now, but was when it hit shore. But if it had hit as Category 4, and it looked like it was going to, they were saying it was the first one in history. We are now four named storms at this point in time. In the first week of July, that's never happened before. What we are seeing clearly, climate scientists say, is the consequence of global warming. Coral dying around the world, species dying off, ice melting, the North Atlantic currents getting wobbly and destabilized, temperature extremes, look to see, terrible problems again in Europe this summer with heat, and tropical storms rendering Hawaii virtually unlivable, or excuse me, Florida virtually unlivable. I mean, this whole issue with these. And why could it be? Because there's too many people consuming too much fossil fuel and pumping it out into the air. Now, I am not advocating mass death of people, but I am suggesting, that is to say that we reduce our population dramatically. But history tells us that when population exceeds particular thresholds, strange things happen. One of them is that people begin behaving in really dangerous, really odd, really sociopathic ways. And it's not just people. I mean, the studies back in the 1950s, the university studies here in the United States, where they progressively increased the population density of rats, and they found at certain thresholds, rats stopped having babies. They started acting viciously towards each other. They started eating their young. They started engaging in behavior that rats normally don't engage in. Sociopathic behavior, psychopathic behavior, criminal behavior on the part of rats as a consequence of population density. Hey, we're mammals too. Of course, rats aren't producing greenhouse gases. I mean, there's even more side effects to this. But just consider, if we were to simply go back to the number of people on planet Earth in 1960. Now, I remember 1960. It was a very good year. Right? I was 9 years old. I remember the year. I remember watching Jack Kennedy get inaugurated on a black and white TV. I remember the Nixon-Kennedy debates. That year, 1960, there were fewer than half as many people on the planet as there are today. The population of the world has more than doubled since 1960. In fact, it doubled in 1999. From 1960 to 1999, the population of the world doubled. There were 3 billion people in 1960. There's over 6 billion now. We're heading towards 7. Now, if you go back from 1960 to 1930, there were only 2 billion people on planet Earth. You know, my parents were alive in 1930, and there was one-third as many people. In other words, if two out of every three people on Earth were to vanish, or if we were to have a very effective... No, I'm not suggesting the rapture or plague, although the bird flu thing is getting kind of scary. We're going to get into that later on in the program, too. Some new discoveries in that area. But if we were to say, okay, we're going to engage in a significant and draconian, not necessarily draconian, but drastic, an aggressive birth control program. It wouldn't have to be the Chinese government, if you have a second child, you go to prison, kind of, you know, you must have an abortion. I don't think it needs to be like that. Because what you find is that in many European countries, they actually have negative population growth right now. Not just zero, negative. And among large demographic groups in the United States, you have negative population growth. The white American middle class, for example, negative population growth. I'm not sure if this is a middle class phenomena in general or not. I suspect it may well be, regardless of race. That would be my guess. I haven't seen any statistics on that recently. But the point is that if you look at middle-class populations around the world, they tend to say, okay, enough. Let's maintain this lifestyle. Let's not create more competition for resources. You go back to the Black Death in Europe in, what was it, 1340, as I recall, 1340 to 1342, whenever it was. Anyhow, the Black Death, the Black Plague, wiped out a third of Europe, killed off a third of Europeans. What was the result of that? The Renaissance. Now the population versus resource ratio changes. There's a third as many people, but there's still just as many trees. There's still just as much farmland. There's still just as many minerals. The number, and so now everybody is one-third richer than they were. And what did that do? It led to the birth of the first European middle class in the middle of what was a feudalistic society. And you had the Renaissance, which led directly to the Enlightenment of the 1600s, which led, you know, and the thinking of the Enlightenment, Rousseau, John Locke, led directly to the American experiment with democracy. So in a very real way, you could say that, you know, population is one of the biggest problems we're facing, and that if we were to address it intelligently, by promoting birth control programs around the world, and stop this weird parochialism, then we could solve many of the problems of the world. The weird parochialism? Well, it goes back to tribalism. It goes back to the time when, you know, be fruitful and multiply, right? God telling people, be fruitful and multiply. The whole idea that the tribe that has the greatest number of people will have the greatest number of potential warriors, and they will therefore win the war. And so you've got, for example, in the Middle East, the Israelis and the Palestinians, both of them are trying to have as many babies as possible, or at least subgroups within both populations, trying to have as many babies as possible so that they can claim, oh, we have more people, so we should have more land. This doesn't serve anybody. Doesn't serve them. It doesn't serve anybody. But it's the way that it was 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. The tribe with the largest army was the tribe that won. It wasn't about technology, it wasn't about smarts, it was about population. But it's not anymore. All of human history, I mean, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years as fully modern humans, and in 1800 we achieved our first 1 billion people. I mean, when Columbus was just circling the world, there were fewer than a billion people. That is like 700 million people on the entire planet. Less than 1 billion. And I don't think anybody would say the planet was unpopulated. If six out of seven people alive today were to vanish, you'd have a world that it was as densely populated as when Columbus discovered North America. All of human history to 1800, the first 1 billion people in the year 1800. The second billion didn't take another 150,000 years. The second billion only took 150 years. Excuse me, not 130 years, 1930. The third billion didn't take 130 years. It only took 30 years, 1960. The fourth billion didn't even take 30 years. It only took 13 years, 14 years, 1974. The third, fifth billion took 13 years, 1987. And the sixth billion took only 11 or 12 years, 1999. And now we're working on the seventh billion. And yet you have groups, I mean, the Catholic Church loudly and proudly proclaiming a couple of years ago that the Pope gave a special speech on it, where they just surpassed 1 billion people. The Muslims, hey, we're more than 1 billion people. As if numbers, as if quantity rather than quality of life was the important thing. We really, I'm not going to flog this much longer other than to say that according to the United Nations, by 2050, and that this includes the trends for death from AIDS in Africa, everything. According to the UN, by 2050, there'll be 2.6 more billion people here. Now, that's the entire world's population in the 1950s, 2.6 billion people. We're going to add that between now and 2050 over the next 45 years. Can the Earth sustain it? It doesn't look like it. Before the age of oil, which really began in the 1850s, big time. Before the age of oil, there was just roughly 1 billion people on planet Earth. That was it. That's what we could sustain using current sunlight, using wood energy. And even at that, we were wiping out ecosystems, and we had cities that were hellholes. 1 billion people. So we have about 5 billion people who are living pure and simple, able to live only because we're using oil. And here we've hit peak oil now worldwide, more or less now in the United States back in the 70s. How are we going to feed all these people? How are we going to transit? We can't. This really and truly is a crisis that we need to confront. And we're not confronting it. In fact, if anything, we're denying it. And here... The G8 just met, and Bush claims a victory. They didn't. In fact, several of the right-wing sites, they sent me talking points that the right-wing talk show hosts are using, talking about how wonderful it is that the G8 did not set specific goals and timetables for cleaning up carbon dioxide. George Bush had a great victory. He was the only leader among the other seven, among all eight nations, who thought that it was a bad idea to set timetables and goals, and he got his way. Isn't that a great victory for the cons? Well, they think so. At the same time, Hurricane Dennis gathered strength with extremely dangerous 150-mile-an-hour winds. It bore down on central Cuba on Friday, on track for the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, where it is now. Strongest Atlantic hurricane to form early this season since records began in 1851. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The polar caps are melting at a rapid pace.
Oh, yeah.
And rising ocean levels soon could harm the human race. But they have got no proof their theories are correct. Our corporations don't get.
Welcome back, my friends. 26 minutes after the hour. 25 minutes and 15 seconds past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. U.S. President George W. Bush resisted efforts by U.K. Prime Minister Tony Blair and French President Jacques Chirac to cooperate with European Union nations on cutting pollution, blamed for global warming, says the Associated Press. At the same time, Hurricane Dennis gathering strength. Well, now it's dissipating it, but it's doing some serious harm here in the United States. And yet, you won't see in the American press a link between the two. Now, I remember when I was, the last time I was in Australia, it was about 3 years ago. And I was in Sydney. We were staying with some friends. I was giving a series of speeches around the country. Actually, Neil Donald Walsh and I spoke at the big stadium there in Sydney. I don't know, a couple thousand people showed up, and in Brisbane and in Melbourne. Anyhow, I was there, and I was staying with some friends, and the TV was on, the TV news, and the weather forecast, or it wasn't the weather forecast, they were having these fires that were coming up near the Sydney, all over New South Wales. And the forecaster comes on and says, well, if global warming has caused the forest to dry out in a rather unnatural fashion. I'm paraphrasing from three-year-old memory here, but this is pretty much the gist of what he said. It has caused the forest to dry out in a fairly unnatural fashion. And so as a result of that, we're getting these incredible forest fires that are causing all these problems. And the predictions as a result of global warming are that this part of Australia and this part of Australia are going to get drier and this part's going to get wetter. And I mean, it was all very matter of fact. And you would not hear that here in the United States. No siree. Our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. Our chat room, TomHartman.com. Click live chat if you want to drop in for one of the finest conversations in all of the internet. Gary in Montana in a truck on the line. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Great talking to you, Tom. I was a salesman once upon a time for a few years. I learned that when you're dealing with an emotional issue, you just answer with a logical answer and vice versa. If you're dealing with a logical issue, you answer with an emotional issue. I'm wondering if in our dealing with the issues today, if since most of them are basically, or a lot of the issues are emotional issues that people have, if we would be better dealing with them with these straight-on, hard-line, logical facts and figures like you're talking about more. Statistics, graphs, that sort of thing, if they'd be more, have more impact and more convincing power.
Yeah, you make a good point, Gary. Although, you know, if you were trying to, for example, with life insurance, what you're describing is the classic thing with life insurance. You know, somebody asks a question about, well, you know, how much money is it going to cost? And then you ask them, well, you know, do you want your family to be left high and dry kind of thing?
Exactly.
Yeah,
lot of the issues we're dealing with have to do with, I mean, there's in everything, the two issues are involved, both logical and emotional. But a lot of people, you know, are a supporting push because of emotional things without really a real good basis in reality and logic.
Right, although they do have to have some sort of rationalization. They have to have some belief that there is some reality. You have to have both features and benefits. You have to have the what's in it for me, why should I care? That's what you're talking about, the emotional piece.
Absolutely. I just wanted the logical to convince more of them.
Well, you have to have both. You must have both. You must have both the feature and the benefit. The feature, what is it? The benefit, what's in it for me? If you don't have both, you're toast.
If you don't have both, they'll go buy it from somebody else.
There you go. So I'm trying to give you both. Gary, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
What you waiting for? Get active, my friends. Get out there. Get political. Get involved. Welcome back. Our telephone number 866-889-8894. I'm Tom Hartman. The website TomHartman.com will get you to our blog, and to our live chat room, which is where you can drop in. There's some interesting links. Somebody put up a link. Yes. Questions being answered. Questions being asked. If you want to know something, I'm telling you, if you want to know anything, if you want to know about the mating habits of the Siberian clam, go to our chat room. If you want to know about what's going on in Iraq, certainly go to our chat room. Quite remarkable. BBC reported this morning, 9 building workers have died in Iraq. 9 building workers. Building workers? As in, like, people who are building buildings? Well, it turns out that they were arrested on suspicion of insurgent activity. There was a firefight between U.S. forces and insurgents in the area where these guys were working. And one of the guys got hit with a gunshot, got hit with a bullet. Now, we don't know their story, because the Iraqi security forces hauled them off and wouldn't allow them to talk to the press. But 12 people were taken hostage, or were taken prisoner by the Iraqi security forces, were interrogated, and were put in metal boxes in the sun. 9 of those 12, during the day that it happened, 9 of the 12 died from being in the box in the sun. They took them to the hospital. Eight were already dead. One died at the hospital. The 3 men who survived, said that they had been given repeated, quoting here, a doctor told the BBC that one of the survivors had said he had been given repeated electric shocks by the commandos. The survivors were kept under police guard as they were treated and were taken away without being allowed to speak to journalists. Recent UK press reports have alleged police commandos systematically torture and abuse detainees. The security forces themselves are the target of much of Iraq's insurgency violence. Could it be that Iraqis are attacking the security forces not because they're American puppets, but because they don't like being tortured? That Saddam's torturers are back? Only now they're working for Alawi? Could it be? I'm assuming you saw over the weekend where Alawi says that Iraq is on the edge of a civil war. Why? He says because there aren't stable institutions of government. Now, might that be because the Bushies, the neocons, don't actually believe in stable government? I think so. I think this is the Bushies. Government does have a protective role. Government does have a protective capacity because there are predators among us. We have a long history. We have a 230-year history in this country of saying, okay, we want government to protect us from the predator. It's called police departments. There are also natural dangers and sometimes man-made dangers, like fire. We want fire department. We want to be protected from them as well. There are diseases we'd like to be protected from. So we have the CDC, the USDA, the FDA. We want to be protected from foreign enemies. We have the military. But you have to get that the neocons, these so-called conservatives who have taken over the House, the Senate, and the White House, particularly the White House, they don't believe in representative government. They don't. They believe in rule by an elite few, those elite few being the captains of industry. Turn everything over to corporations. That's their motto. That's their mantra. Turn it over to corporations, and you got it. Here's just one example. This is like proof positive that that's what these guys are up to. Here in the United States, they're running around talking about the death tax. You got the Walton family funding this big effort to end the death tax. We've got to end the death tax. We've got to put an end to the... And what they're talking about, of course, with the death tax, is the inheritance tax. You had George Bush in 2001 saying that he had met with a group of farmers who had lost their farms because of the inheritance tax. And then they said, well, who were those farmers? Well, I don't remember. Turns out there weren't any. In fact, they haven't been able to find any farmers. Turns out if you have a farm that is worth the $3 million that would be necessary for any part of it, and it would only be the part worth over $3 million, to be hit by the inheritance tax, then you have enough money to have a CPA. And if you have a CPA, they say to you, hey, if you own this farm, you need to have a life insurance policy that will pay the inheritance tax. And these policies are very common. This year, there are about 20 farms that may be subject to an inheritance tax. All of them have life insurance policies. It's not an issue. Why does Bush make it an issue? Why does he say he met with these farmers when he didn't? Because, you know, he just makes stuff up as he goes along. Sort of like Chuck Hagel said he's doing the war in Iraq. He said, you know, Chuck Hagel, the Republican Chuck Hagel. Well, they're just making it up as they go along. I'm telling you, it's real. Bush, this is something that Bush just does. Doesn't matter if it's real or not. He just makes it up as he's going along. This is why it's not proof of complicity in 9/11. I can't tell you how many emails I get from people about this. Every time I mention it, it's really quite remarkable. The number of people who say, George Bush saying that he sat outside a classroom in Florida and watched the first plane hit the World Trade Tower on a TV monitor, that George Bush saying that is proof that he was part of the conspiracy, because we, the people, didn't have footage of that until the day after. On the day of 9/11, there was no video coverage of the first plane hitting the first tower. None. I mean, you know, news cameras don't just sit around pointed at the top, at the first tower. It took a whole day before some tourist realized that they had this thing on videotape and tracked down a network and sold it to them. It was the next day that that came out. Now, once the first tower was hit, every camera in New York was pointed up at the World Trade Center, so there's all kinds of pictures of the second plane hitting, but none of the first. And so people say, well, Bush saying that he saw the first plane hit is proof that he must have had some secret, they must have been secretly monitoring the thing, and he's sitting down there in Florida waiting for the plane to hit, and he's got the secret monitor camera with him because he's part of the conspiracy. Well, in fact, yeah, you know, I can just share Bush saying that with you if you'd like. Here it is.
Well, Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower the TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And I said, it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
See, I'm telling you, he just makes this stuff up as it goes along. You know, if it's what this tells me is not that George Bush was part of a conspiracy to run airplanes into the 9/11 towers. It tells me that he's a pathological liar. And it's the same thing with the death tax, him saying that he's got all these families who lost their farms. Yes, indeed, they lost their farms. Well, you want to know what the real death tax is? The real death tax is on the American middle class. And it's that the only way that you can get Medicare to pay for long-term nursing home coverage or Alzheimer's treatments or medical expenses, which will wipe you out if you're in the middle class in a matter of months or years, the only way you can get Medicare to pay for it is to give 100% of all of your assets to the medical industry, to Bill Frist's industry. That's the real death tax. Great piece in the New York Times on the 9th of July. The middle class struggles in the Medicaid maze. If I said Medicare, I meant Medicaid. And they talk about how there's a whole new subspecialty in law emerging of lawyers who help people shelter their assets so that if they or their spouse ends up with Alzheimer's or with cancer or something and they have to go into long-term care, that Medicare will pick up for it, but will pick up the tab. Because Medicare will only do it if you're broke. And you've got all these people who have worked all their lives. They're now in their 60s, 70s, 80s. They spent 30, 40, 50 years working their butts off. And they got a couple $100,000 in the bank, and they think that they're secure. Because a couple $100,000 in the bank is big money to the American middle class. And then they discover that it costs $100,000, $150,000 a year just to go into an Alzheimer's treatment facility or into a retirement home. And the only way Medicaid will pay for it, regardless of how old you are, is if you are absolutely destitute and without resources. And so you have to become destitute. How do you become destitute? You give all your money to the care facility. So Bill Frist's family, that the medical industry, takes away all of the assets of the American middle class just before they die, so that they then qualify for Medicare. And in fact, if you try and give that money to your family within 3 years before you go into care, that's considered a crime. That's like evading, that's evading giving money to the medical industry. You can't do that. They'll go back and get it back from you. If you try to give all your money to your kids within 3 years of the time that you need care, they'll come to your kids and say, give that money to that hospital. Bill Frist's family, his Bill Frist's daddy needs to become a, he's one of the richest men in America. He's a multi-billionaire. He needs more billions. The real death tax is leaving every, they want to make every single last member of the American middle class absolutely destitute when they die. And they're doing it. They're doing it. I mean, this is the Republican, they're doing it. And they're successful at it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Will in Brea, California on the line. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, what's up? I just wanted to get in on the idea of the fascism that's going on. I totally love what you're saying. Thank you so much. Say it again.
There you go. Amen, brother.
I'm about to go off to jail probably pretty quick here, being a medical marijuana user.
Oh, gee.
And obviously, this has been done for the pharmaceutical companies to make money, because all of a sudden, after years of telling and screaming how there's no medical benefits, none whatsoever, but unless you get it from this pharmaceutical company this way, because if you smoke it like we do cigarettes, it'll hurt us.
Right, or make tea out of it. So now they're coming out with a pot pill. They've got a THC tablet.
We're going to stop you and take all your stuff to make you take it our way, because that's the only way it's good for you.
That's right. That's right.
And our companies will make money. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Later.
There you go. Yeah, thanks, Will. Yeah, good point. It's a tragedy. It's just an absolute tragedy. The corporatization of America. They always give you false choices. They say, do you want the government to be making choices about your health care? Remember those ads, those Harry and Sally ads, or Harry and Sue, or whatever, Harry and Louise ads, for the health care industry? Back during the Clinton administration, where they were trying to shoot down Clinton's health care program. Do you want the government making decisions about your health care? Do you want the government picking your doctor? No, I don't. But what they should have said was, would you rather have the government make decisions about your health care, or your private for-profit insurance company that's not answerable to you, that you can't vote in new elected representatives? Which would you rather have making the choices? Because that's the real choice. And in saying, no, we don't want our government making the choices, we ended up with private for-profit corporations making the choices. And who gets screwed? We do. Steve in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, not a lot, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to call and say, I got on my vehicle, I have a bumper sticker. It says, arrogance and ignorance is bad foreign policy. Mr. Bush proves this point every time he opens his mouth, and I just wanted to convey that to you and the listeners.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. Well said. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan.
Hey, what's up, Tom? I wanted to just comment that, you know, this conservatives talk about 50 years of judicial activism. It seems like they're actually talking about desegregation, and that was actually a form of judicial activism.
It was.
Is that true?
It was. In fact, that's where the term actually originated, was as a complaint by conservatives about the Supreme Court integrating the South. Yeah.
Yeah, when they talk
it was Brown versus Board of Education that was the original activist judge position that got the conservatives in the South, who, by the way, at that time were mostly Democrats, all bent out of shape.
Yeah, but I mean, is this kind of thing, I mean, they want to roll back that as well? I mean, What kind of rollback are they looking at here?
Well, this is the point that Joe Biden makes every time he goes on a talk show, when he talks about, or no, Arlen Specter, excuse me, the Republican Arlen Specter makes every time he goes on a talk show, was, you know, they say, well, you fought Robert Bork. And he goes, well, you know, Bork was a strict constructionist. If Bork had been on the Supreme Court, he would have said, hey, the founders intended that there be slavery. We need to go back to slavery.
Okay. Well, thanks, Tom.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. It's and he's right. I mean, that's, you know, you want strict constructionism. There you go. Tim and Tom in Minneapolis. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I was just want to elaborate a little bit. You talked about the neocons, that they don't believe in representative government.
They don't.
Exactly. And you offered the proof with the death tax analogy. And more proof is that this neocon paradise in Iraq, they outlawed democracy in the workplace. No voice.
That's right. No unions.
Citizens. citizens in their workplace, right? Half their waking life. And of course, like you always say, they cannot admit this. So they must conflate the language of corporatism with democracy, right?
Yeah.
Peace is war. You know, laissez-faire is really democracy. And you're right. And they're just like this Ayn Rand crazy.
Yeah, it's I wouldn't say they're just like them. I'd say that they're actually far more toxic than the Ayn Rand folks, because these guys are ideologues who believe in a very, very false ideology. Tom, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Through the dark I search again for a universal refrain.
And welcome back, my friends. 5.5 minutes before the hour. 5 minutes before the hour. 4.5 minutes before the hour. There we go. Trying to figure out our clocks here. Welcome back to the program. I'm Tom Hartman. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. The chat room, John in Hersey, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Great. Last week after the terrorist attacks in London, Media Matters points out that Fox News top anchorman Brett Hume gave us a glimpse into just how cynical, greedy, and disgusting the right-wing's outlook on the world is.
Yeah.
Did you hear his comment?
Yeah, he said, when I see this happening, I think I should buy.
Right. When I saw the futures market, which was really in a tank, I thought, time to buy.
Yeah.
That was his personal first opinion on the terrorist attacks.
Yeah, and now...
disgusting.
And these guys have been spinning it ever since. What astounds me is that Democrats are afraid, unwilling and afraid, to use the attacks in London as an opportunity to say, George Bush has left us even more vulnerable than Tony Blair left London. We have not protected our homeland. We have not protected the United States. We have not protected our rail system. In fact, if anything, Bush has been cutting protection for the rail system. We're spending an amount of money equal to the entire FBI budget on frisking Granny at the airport. And we're not checking the cargo that goes into the planes. We're not checking our ports. And you get Rush Limbaugh on the air saying, oh, it doesn't matter. We don't have to protect our ports. We don't have to, because we're fighting the terrorists over there. If we can get enough of the terrorists dead over there, they'll never come over, which is stupid to begin with. And secondly, if that's the case, Limbaugh, then why do we have to frisk Granny on the airplane if we're so effectively killing all of them over in the Middle East? I mean, it's just the insanity of these right-wingers. It's just beyond me.
It's also a strange coincidence that this occurs just before discussions about the startup on renewal of the Patriot Act.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the national ID card in England. I mean, this is the big thing in England. John, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. It's just the national ID card. Trust me, it's going to happen in England. It just happened here in the United States. Most Americans don't even know it, that the Real ID Act has passed through Congress, and I believe it's been signed into law by President Bush, which means that sometime in the next couple of years, I think it takes about 2 years for it to be fully implemented, sometimes in the next couple of years, your driver's license is going to have a transponder in it, an RFID chip, where if you walk within a quarter of a mile, I mean, given the advances in technology, maybe even within a few miles of any place that has a scanner, they know who you are, they have your thumbprint, they have your retinal scan, they know your address, your Social Security. It'll be like the Tom Cruise movie. You walk up to a store and says, well, hello, Mr. Jones. How's Mrs. Jones? How's the dog? Oh, I see the dog died yesterday. What a shame. Why don't you come in and buy a new dog? It's the pet store. It is welcome to the brave new world, brought to you by the neocons and George W. Bush.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
The London disaster is proof that Bush failed to nab bin Laden, says Workplace Democracy in our chat room. You can get there by going to TomHartmann.com and clicking live chat if you want information, answers to any kind of questions, and if you want to hang out with some really, really fine people. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. From outside the United States, 1-503-248-0620. And welcome back to our program. The White House, we're up to day six now. Day six that the White House is silent about Karl Rove. You will recall, of course, the Joe Wilson, our ambassador to actually several different countries over the course of his career. In 1991, as George Bush Sr. was about to attack Iraq, Joe Wilson was actually our representative in Iraq. And here he is about his wife, Valerie Plame, being outed as a CIA agent, thus bringing down an entire CIA counterintelligence operation.
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
And, of course, Joe Wilson, being an ambassador, doesn't just throw names around easily. He's not one of these wild and crazy guys. Very thoughtful guy. Very deliberate.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
So here you have, now that was 2.5 years ago, you have a former U.S. ambassador in the public media saying Karl Rove is responsible for this, for committing treason in the White House. Who was the person who brought down a CIA counterterrorism operation and damaged America's ability to fight the war against terror? It was some traitor in the White House. And you have Joe Wilson in public saying it was Karl Rove. But George Bush, he doesn't seem quite so curious, even though his name is George.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Don't have any idea. Well, the White House on Friday posted the transcript of that day's press gaggle, that when all the media gets together and talks about what's what. For the fourth straight time, since his lawyer admitted that Rove was one of Matt Cooper's sources, notes Judd over on the Think Progress blog, no member of the White House press corps asked a question about Karl Rove's role. I'm telling you, the press corps is just as intimidated about Karl Rove as the Democrats are about London. The press corps is terrified. No, none of these guys wants to ask about Karl Rove. Why? Because they're afraid Karl Rove will come after them. It's like if the mafia controlled the media and you went to the media and you said, I know something about John Gotti. Do you think he'd live very long? Well, it's a good metaphor because the Bush mafia controls the White House. And if you're in the White House press corps and you want to ever talk again to anybody from the White House and you raise Karl Rove's name now, you're going to see the end of your career. I mean, that's it. You're toast. And it's not like there's a shortage of questions to ask. I mean, this is a major scandal. This is like Watergate. This is certainly more important than somebody having sex with an intern. That didn't endanger the nation's security. That endangered somebody's marriage. There's a difference. We're talking about something that could and may well have led to the death of American agents of the Central Intelligence Agency, and certainly to the death of Americans and American soldiers, because our intelligence service was compromised by this behavior by Karl Rove. It's not as if Scotty McClellan has never discussed this, by the way. 2 years ago, on September 23rd, An intrepid reporter in the White House said, all right, let me just follow up. You said this morning the president knows that Karl Rove wasn't involved. How does he know that? How does he know that? And Scotty McClellan says, well, I've made it very clear that it was a ridiculous suggestion in the first place. I saw some comments this morning from the person who made that suggestion backing away from that, and I said it is simply not true. So, I mean, it's public knowledge. I've said it's not true, and I've spoken with Karl Rove. He's, by the way, referring, when he says the person who made that suggestion, he's referring to Joe Wilson. So Scotty McClellan saying, it ain't true. You think anybody in the White House press corps is going to say, Scotty, you assured us at one point in time that this was just absolutely not true. Is it not true, really? We'll see. In the meantime, Karl Rove's lawyer, talking to Bloomberg News, Robert Luskin, has he goofed? Is he lying? Or is there something that we're missing altogether here? He told Bloomberg News on July 3rd, quote, Karl Rove did nothing wrong, did not disclose Plame's identity, and did not reveal any confidential information, end quote. And yet when you read Matt Cooper's email to Time Magazine of July 11th, 2003, he said it was Karl Rove, said, Wilson's wife, who apparently works at the Agency on Weapons of Mass Destruction Issues, who authorized the trip. That trip being Joe Wilson's trip to Africa to find out, to Niger, to find out if it was possible that that bogus memo that George Bush was quoting in his State of the Union speech, the forgery, speaking of forgeries, talk to Dan Rather, that forgery that George W. Bush was quoting in his Weapons of Mass Destruction speech was real. And Joe Wilson gets down there and he finds down to Niger and he finds out, yes, it's definitely a forgery and there's, you know, no uranium from here has gone to Iraq. Sorry. And he goes back and he writes an op-ed piece for the New York Times saying, Bush is lying to us. Now, he says it in his diplomatic language. He says it very, you know, cautiously and carefully and, you know, but still, it majorly upset the White House. I mean, the White House was like, what? We can't have this. Somebody telling truth when we're trying to whip the American people into a frenzied state of terror. We can't have somebody telling truth about things. It won't work. It's not the Bushy way. Speaking of the Bushy way, his weekend radio address, George Bush, on the 9th of July, the terrorists believe that with a few hard blows and the televised repetition of horrific images of violence, they can force us to retreat. No, sorry, George. Not true. What they want you to do is they want you to attack. They really do. They love it when you do that. You make them heroes. You help their movement. Bin Laden was this little guy that nobody was paying attention to. He had been thrown out of his own country, Saudi Arabia. If he went to Sudan, the Sudanese threw him out. He got thrown out of Sudan. He had been thrown out of several different countries. Finally, he makes his way to Afghanistan. There's this little bizarre, little misogynist paradise there. His vision of how the rest of the world should be. And he says to us, you have soldiers in Saudi Arabia. You've got men in Saudi Arabia who are drinking alcohol. You have women in Saudi Arabia who are walking around with their arms uncovered. They're voting. They're driving cars. This is intolerable. Any good religious fundamentalist knows this. It's intolerable, says Bin Laden. And so if you don't take your troops out of Saudi Arabia, who were put there in 1991, by the way, then we're going to come and get you. And sure enough, he did. Bin Laden has been at this for two decades, at least. First against the Soviets. Now against us. And Bush says, okay, if he hits us, we're just going to hit him again, and hit him again, and hit him again. It's not like there's a him. It's a them. And it's not like it's a finite number of them. When Bin Laden was just Bin Laden and nobody'd ever heard of him, it was Bin Laden and maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people. Enough to have mobilized Interpol against and to have arrested and brought to justice. But now, Now, bin Laden is more liked in the Arab world and in the Muslim world than is the United States of America. We are doing his work for him. And not only has George W. Bush done bin Laden's work for him, you know, creating a recruiting tool for bin Laden, but he's also been doing the work for Iran. Iran wanted Saddam Hussein out of office. He's out of office. They wanted Iraq to have elections so that the Shia could take control of the country. They had elections. The Shia are taking control of the country. They wanted to work out a deal where they could put Iranian soldiers into Iraq. We're putting Iranian there, and they just signed it last week. You're now going to see Iranian soldiers. $1 billion deal. Iran is going to help rebuild Iraq. Iran is going to help run the Iraqi military. Isn't that sweet? I mean, the whole reason why we helped overthrow Mossadegh and put Saddam Hussein in there in the first place was to act as a buffer against the power of the Ayatollah and the religious in Iran. So George W. Bush has given the Iranians what they want, and he's given bin Laden what he wants. And the Iranians are still in power in Iran, and soon will be in power in Iraq, and bin Laden is still alive. You have to ask yourself the question, whose side is George W. Bush on? I think John Tierney made such a good point in a post that was made to the Huffington Post. I'm not exactly sure where this first appeared. But the headline is, it might be the New York Times, actually. Yeah, it is. It's in the New York Times. Excuse me. The headline is, When Fear Stalks, Tune Out. And he starts out, he says, Tony Blair was as eloquent as ever when he faced the press at the G8 summit meeting yesterday, but what was most impressive was what he didn't say. After uttering three sentences of gratitude to the other leaders for their support after the London attacks, Tony Blair dropped the subject of terror. Three sentences, thank you for your support, then he dropped it. Instead of giving murderers publicity on worldwide television, he talked about poverty in Africa and global warming. When a reporter tried to distract him by asking what went wrong in London, he said it was terrorist fault and went right back to the business of the G8. That's leadership rather than demagoguery. All we've been getting out of Bush is demagoguery. What a travesty. What a shame for America. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Working in a coal mine, going on down, now working in a coal mine, about to slip down.
And welcome back, my friends. Our program brought to you today by High Technology for Low Prices, Small Dog Electronics. And if you like the program and you'd like Small Dog Electronics, you'd like to learn more about them, give them a call, toll free, 1-800-511-MAX. M-A-C-S, 1-800-511-MACS for Small Dog Electronics. Let them know that you support the program and that you'd like their catalog, you'd like to know what they're up to. And if you have anything computer, not just Macintosh, anything computerized, 1-800-511-MAX, Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices. So, yeah, there you go, working in a coal mine. So, back here, Tony Blair has a horrific terrorist attack in England, and he goes back to the G8 meeting, and what does he do? Does he wring his hands? Does he say, we are going to get these people? Does he get a bullhorn? We're coming after you. We're going to smoke you out dead or alive. You hear me? No. No. He says, we have problems in the world with poverty. We have problems in the world with global warming. These are real issues that will affect billions of people, and that are affecting them right now. We must do something about them. He's a statesman. He deals with the real issues of the day. Rather than demagoguing, rather than using the death of 50-some-odd people to gain political advantage, to get what George W. Bush referred to as political capital. Rather than doing that, he addresses the real issues of the day. What a contrast. What a contrast. John Turney points out, he says, the assurances that the police were on the case meant nothing because there was obviously no way to stop one guy with a rifle from shooting me that evening. He's talking about walking home after the blasts in London. You see, that's the same situation we're in after the London attacks. It's clear that no one can stop terrorists from killing. Spending billions on airport security has simply diverted them to transit systems. And spending billions on transit systems will divert them someplace else. Stores, restaurants, sidewalks. Terrorists don't even need bombs. They could simply become like the sniper, the Washington, D.C. sniper that terrorized that city. Was it John Malvo was his name? President Bush, says John Turney, briefly admitted last summer to Matt Lauer that the war on terror could not ever be won. But he got so much criticism that he promptly backtracked. It was a textbook Washington gaffe. Perfectly true, but terribly inconvenient. The bottom line, very simple, very eloquently stated, that the truth of this by Tony Blair, just absolutely straightforward. We're about the people's business. We're about doing the things that need to be done. This is what a statesman says, or a stateswoman. We're about the people's business. Whereas George W. Bush, boy, you can bet that he wouldn't get back to business after a terrorist attack. He would ring it for all it was. I mean, his campaign in 2004, 2 years after, 3 years after 2001, their campaign ads, they're showing firefighters carrying a flag-draped coffin out of the rubble of 9/11, and it was staged. They had to stage it to make the commercial. George W. Bush still uses 9/11. Every speech he gives, he talks about 9/11. It's the only thing he can hold his hat on, or hang his hat on. This is it. That was his moment in the sun when he went from becoming the illegitimate president that the majority of Americans did not vote for, that we didn't want as president, to being the guy who could be there during a time of national tragedy. And boy, is he milking that. And now we discover, in Iraq, as the cost of the Iraqi occupation spirals, British and American oil companies meet in secret to carve up the country's oil resources for themselves. Did you hear this? This meeting, it was last week. The week before last. The Iraq war has so far cost America and Britain £105 billion, but the financial clawback is gathering pace. Yeah. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I've seen mornings when 1,000 bales of hay look like a mountain to a boy my age. And I've seen my daddy in that hot southern sun move those mountains one by one. I've seen that same man come home from the mill, pull 40 hours for $100 bill.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes before the hour, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website. Wendy Wang is with us, our correspondent from Washington, D.C. Hey, Wendy.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am great. What's happening in the belly of the beast there?
Oh, my goodness. So many things going on this morning. Of course, Scott McLaughlin gave his usual morning gaggle with the president's schedule. But in the middle of it all, the question of Karl Rove and his possible involvement in revealing Valerie Plame's cover was, of course, a topic for discussion. First of all, many reports.
Finally,
exactly. That was Ellen's reaction as well. Basically, reporters asked him to recall to a different period of time when he stood before the same press corps and said very firmly that Karl Rove was not involved in any way, shape, or form with revealing Valerie Plame's cover, and he had nothing to do with it. And now they're asking him, well, sir, do you feel any embarrassment about this, or are you going to retract it? And he said, this is an ongoing investigation. I'm not going to comment. And they were like, but you commented before on this, and it was an ongoing investigation before as well, but you had said that Karl Rove was not involved whatsoever. And so he was called to the mat, and he stood firm, and he said, I'm not going to give any comment whatsoever.
Doesn't sound like standing firm, Wendy. It sounds like weaseling out.
Weaseling out. Those are your words, exactly. I'm just relaying the message here. And also, of course, as you know, Congress came back into session, and he was asked why the president did not choose to nominate John Bolton during the recess, as it was within his right to do so, and he said that he was waiting for Congress to do its job and give him an up or down vote.
Maybe George doesn't want Bolton either?
You know, he might have changed his mind. It's really causing a lot of headache. What do you think?
My take on it is that the Republicans are putting a lot of pressure on Bush to just, you know, let it go.
Right,
and Bush
yeah.
is trying to figure out a way to do it and save face. But time will tell. Time will tell,
exactly. And also, as you know, the DNC raised $28.5 million within the first 6 months of this year.
That's wonderful.
How about that?
That's wonderful. Howard Dean is doing his job.
It looks like he is. $28.5 million is quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
And also, the Congress, something interesting from Congress, as you would recall, Jack Abramoff, that very infamous name, got a little bit into a bit of trouble with that $9 million he raised from the Indian tribes, and now everybody is kind of afraid to take lobby-sponsored trips or anything to do with lobbyists, so I think there's a little bit of a scaled-back activity on the Hill in
right.
terms of August recess. So.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear, too. Okay, Wendy Wang, thank you so much for the report today from Washington, D.C.
Not a problem.
Much appreciated. Great to hear from you. It's 27 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Pat in Ann Arbor, Michigan on the line. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hey, got some breaking news for you, Tom.
Okay.
Last week, Monday or Tuesday, you were talking about Leonard Clark.
Yes,
He's
sir.
He's a soldier from Iraq, and
yes.
he was blogging.
And his blog got taken down over the weekend.
Well, not only that, according to what's left of his website, leonardclark.com, he was arrested by the Army over the weekend.
Oh, my.
And the charge, according to the guy running his site, as you know, a guy from America was running the site, and he
right.
was calling in and emailing in. The charge was running for Senate while on active duty, because on his blog he said he wanted to run against Kyle when he got back. That's what they got him on. So they couldn't stop him from, you know, his First Amendment right of free speech, so they got him on that. It makes me nuts that they did that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what can we do about that, Pat?
Well, I mean, at least we should, you know, call a radio show and let everybody know that.
Is there any kind of call for action at leonardclark.com? I mean, the last time I looked there, I was getting the website was down totally. I was getting a 404 error, you know, no such website. Is it back up?
LeonardClark.com/blog is definitely up. I was, you know, surfing the blogs over lunch, and I saw it. It was definitely up. There was only two posts, and one said Leonard Clark's been arrested, and then there was another longer post from a friend of Leonard's who's in the same unit or knows him over there with more details.
Yeah.
But that's all we know at this point until they come back, because obviously the guy's been arrested.
Yeah. Well, this administration, it is looking more and more like the mafia every day. It's dealing with the mob. Mike Malloy for years has been talking about the Bush crime family, and I'd been reluctant to use that kind of language. I still am, frankly. But when you look at their behavior, this isn't the tradition of American democracy.
You're either with us or against us.
Yeah, and that's not the tradition of American democracy. The tradition of American democracy is that we tolerate dissent. In fact, we encourage dissent. We celebrate dissent. We celebrate diversity.
Consensus.
That's
yeah.
right, yeah. Okay, Pat, thanks a lot for the call and for the information. As depressing as it is, I appreciate it. It's at least good to know that he wasn't killed by a member of his own unit or something, which he seemed to be implying that he was afraid of. LeonardClark.com/blog. It's a shame, too, that nobody, maybe somebody did, had archived his posts, because I read them on the air here on this program, I think it was about a week ago today or tomorrow, and some strong words that he had. This is a soldier who is in Iraq right now, serving his country in Iraq, talking about the absolute disaster that George W. Bush lied us into. In the meantime, we discover that the oil companies now are behaving they're all a Twitter, right? They are just all a Twitter. There's a conference at remarkable report. Executives from British Petroleum, Shell, ExxonMobil, and Halliburton, Dick Cheney's old firm, congregated at the Paddington Hilton for two-day chinwag. This was in the UK, with top-level officials from Iraq's oil ministry. The gathering, sponsored by the British government, was described as the premier event for those with designs on Iraqi oil, and went on ahead despite opposition from Iraqi oil workers who fear their livelihoods are being flogged to foreigners. That's a Britishism for given away. The Dr. Hussan Rabia, managing director of the consultancy Entrac Petroleum Inc., said this is a networking opportunity for UK businesses involved in Iraqi oil. We have the moral support of the UK government. They're bringing the guys over from Iraq, offering them visas. We expect all the big oil companies to be there. The delegate numbers were described as confidential. The tickets were $1,200 a piece. But Iraqi oil workers are furious about the conference. The second phase of the war will be started by this conference carving up the industry, said an outraged Hassan Juma, head of the Iraqi General Union of Oil Employees. It's about giving shares of Iraq to the countries who invaded it. They get a piece of the action as a reward. The British government will back this action in order to pay its debt in Iraq. Now, here's what's going on. And it's important to understand this in context, to really get at what's going on here. Saddam Hussein had nationalized the oil fields. This is the same thing that Lula, is it? Is he Brazil or Venezuela? In any case, it's the same thing the guy in Venezuela has done that we've got our panties in a wad about, we're all upset about. Down in Venezuela, they nationalized the oil down there and said the money from this oil is going to support everybody in the country. It's a national company. Well, frankly, it's not that different. I believe that Mexico has nationalized their oil, but slightly different way. You know, Pemex, a big player. But anyhow, Saddam Hussein said, okay, all the revenue, all the profit from the oil is going to pay for, infrastructure, build highways, build roads, build hospitals, pay for schools. I mean, it's a great revenue source. This is how, the Norwegians do it. It's going to make our nation rich. And in fact, George Bush, in a way, alluded to this back when he said, don't destroy the oil wells, when he declared that he was going to invade Iraq. That night that he gave that speech to the American people saying that in 48 hours hostilities are going to commence, blah, 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 blah. And he says, now I have something to say to the Iraqi people. And he turned to the Iraqi people and he said,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people.
That belongs to the Iraqi people. It belongs to the Iraqi people. Well, that was then and this is now. Because now it's going to belong to the American oil companies in the era and the British oil companies. Previous form suggested his concerns are well-founded, this being the 23,000 skilled oil workers and their union leader. Keep in mind, Iraq's massive oil reserves are the second richest in the world. The second largest in the world. Nobody in the world, except Saudi Arabia, has as much oil as does Iraq. As Dick Cheney liked to point out.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Say, from no less authority than one of the great oil experts, Dick Cheney. And now they're talking about, let's sell this off. Let's let the multinational corporations come in here at the expense of the Iraqi people. And just do what they will with this oil. the pay for oil workers? About $35 a month. A month. $35 to $40, £25 British. $35, $40 a month. They threatened a strike. And under our noble government, we raised it to £38 a month, about $50 a month. And the head of their union says, we don't need any foreign oil companies in here. Here's a verbatim quote. Iraqi oil workers are good enough to rebuild without any need of help, end quote. After all, they built the oil industry in the first place. But no, we say, no. We're going to do it for you. We'll take care of it. Don't worry, guys. We're going to show you how to run an oil company. Chevron, Exxon, Unocal. We know how to run an oil company. We know how to extract the oil from a country and make sure that the maximum amount of the money from that oil ends up in the hands of American CEOs rather than the people of Iraq. What? People? It's not how we do it in America. People of America don't own the oil. It's whoever's yard they happen to put the pump on. So it should be that way in Iraq, too, we say. How dare you think that just because there's oil underneath your soil and just because some of these oil pools are, you know, 1,000 miles in diameter, that you as a nation should control the wealth from that. Come on. You need a John Rockefeller. 23,000 people in the oil industry in Iraq. Scared to death they're going to all be replaced by Halliburton. Greg Muttit, a researcher with Platform, an independent environmental think tank, says, quote, the decisions on how to carve up Iraq are being made behind closed doors in Washington, London, and Baghdad, end quote. He goes on to say, this conference is a key part of the plan to help multinational companies get stuck in once those arrangements are in place. It's a corporate feeding frenzy. They're not writing recipes. They're tucking in their napkins. And Yahya Saeed, an Iraqi research fellow in global governments at the London School of Economics, added, Iraq's oil is very cheap to extract. Now keep in mind, the oil in Saudi Arabia is starting to get expensive. And yes, in Saudi Arabia, it's also nationalized. It isn't. The Aramco is mostly owned by the Saudi government, but not entirely. But in any case, the Saudi oil is now costing $11, $12, $13, $14, $15 a barrel to pump because they have to inject water down into the wells to force the oil back up. In fact, as much as a third of the oil coming out of the Saudi wells now is water, a third of the stuff coming out, which means that the wells are getting kind of old. It's expensive to pump all that water down there to create enough pressure to blow the oil back up. It's very expensive. Whereas in Iraq, the oil fields are so virgin that you drill into them and it just bubbles to the ground. This conference is like a dating game, says Saeed. Yeah. 1-866-889-8894, a telephone number, Roy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, Roy.
Good morning, Tom. Two points this morning. One, on a sad note, I don't know if you'd heard Andy Stevenson passed away.
I did. I did a little eulogy for him on Friday. Second hour.
I missed it. So, yeah. Okay. I was kind of really...
God rest him.
Kind of a bummer.
Andy's in the light now.
That's right. And he was a good guy and did a lot of good work.
He was.
Hey, maybe he can inspire, you know... We can use him as another inspiration.
There you go.
If we need more.
Patron saint against voting machines.
That's right. I was interested to see that over the weekend there was a couple, three articles. Most importantly, the one by Robin Cook. I believe he was the foreign secretary that resigned in protest, the British foreign secretary that resigned in protest, that is kind of tying bin Laden in with the whole Power of Nightmares BBC story. I mean, it's just perking more and more that, hey, we've got a bunch of thugs out here, and if we just treated them as a criminal element and went after them one after at a time, we could catch them, defuse them, and take care of them. But the way it is, we are making the big boogeyman.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that it can keep us completely. But I was just encouraged that it seems like there's a couple of the mainstream. I mean, this was out of The Guardian. Of course, it has to be in England.
Yeah, well, and The Guardian is viewed as a leftist paper, Roy. But you're absolutely right, and people are starting to wake up, particularly in the U.K. It's Tom Hartman with you, 10 minutes before the hour. Thanks, Roy, for the call.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What gives you the right, hey you, to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me who gave you the power?
Well, it was actually the Supreme Court in the year 2000, and Sandra Day O'Connor was actually the swing vote who decided that George W. Bush would become president. But that's a whole other issue and a whole other time and a whole other take. My question is, when are the Democrats going to wake up and get a spine? The Republicans are shamelessly exploiting this. During the break, I'm here in a radio station complex. There's five radio stations that operate out of this building. And I went to the men's room, and on the speaker is Rush Limbaugh. Right? And he's talking about how, you know, George W. Bush is winning the war on terror and everything is fine. The military is fighting this war and it's just great. You know, quack, 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 quack. And the Republican, and as London's bombings just prove that he's doing the right thing. The Republicans are not losing a moment exploiting what happened in London for political gain. And the Democrats, they're hiding under their chairs. I don't get it. Why aren't the Democrats coming out and saying what happened in London proves that it could happen here, that is nonsense what Bush is saying, that, oh, we're going to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here. That's nonsense. It's juvenile nonsense. This country is not safer. And this guy has dug us into a hole. He's skimping on Homeland Security. Why are the Democrats not saying these kinds of things? Why are they coming? We need an adversarial relationship between the two parties in the United States to have democracy. Jason in Michigan on the line. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Yeah, hey, not too much. Just real quick, I was watching the hearing this morning on the funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and they had all the bigwigs for CPB in front of the Senate, and there were like a couple of good exchanges, but one of the most stark, one of the most, I guess, out front was when Dick Durbin came out and said, you know, he made a comment about the Wall Street Journal Week program. And, you know, I guess in an effort to be balanced, the CPB sought to insert that to counterbalance against Now. And he basically was asking, why do we subsidize Wall Street Journal when, you know, being a pretty successful company, they could finance right. their own programming.
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. It's a good question. And I have some concerns about CPB's programming, too. But I think that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting really should be should fulfill its original mandate in the 1964, as I recall, enabling legislation, that they serve underserved markets. And I don't think the Wall Street Journal is an underserved market, Jason. I agree with you. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where we get our talking points from Jefferson and Madison, not some cranky right-wing think tank.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website. Al-Qaeda's smart bombs. Robert Pape laid this out, and to the best of my knowledge, he's the first guy to have done this research. It's really, really startling. He asks the question, or answers the question, I mean, he gets into the whole issue, basically, of who are these terrorists and what's motivating them? Who are the terrorists who are doing the suicide bombings and what's motivating them? The Al-Qaeda suicide bombings. Because they're, it's being portrayed in the mainstream media that they are Muslim radicals or Muslim fundamentalists, implying somehow that the reason why they're blowing themselves up and taking a lot of other people with them is that they're trying to achieve nirvana, they're trying to get to heaven, they want to get the 72 virgins, they want to get the grapes and figs and the rivers of wine and the, you know, all that stuff described according to some in the Quran. Turns out, it ain't the case. And this is absolutely fascinating, the study that this guy did. He points out that since 2002, Al-Qaeda has been involved in at least 17 bombings that have killed more than 700 people. That's more attacks and victims than in all the years before 9/11 combined. That's just in the last 3 years, 2.5 years. Okay. So he compiled the data on the 71 terrorists who killed themselves between 1995 and 2004 on behalf of what is described as Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. He says, I was able to collect the names, nationalities, and detailed demographic information on 67 of the 71 bombers, and that data provides insight into the underlying causes of Al-Qaeda's suicide terrorism and how the group's strategy has evolved since 2001. He says, most important, and this is something I wish every American could hear this. Most important, the figures show that Al-Qaeda today is less a product of Islamic fundamentalism than of a simple strategic goal to compel the United States and its Western allies to withdraw combat forces from the Arabian Peninsula and other Muslim countries. In other words, they're just trying to get us to leave. This is good old-fashioned nationalism or regionalism, I suppose you could call it in this case. He produces a chart that shows all of the bombings and who the victims were, and then the nationality of the Al-Qaeda suicide attackers. And it's really quite remarkable. 34 of the suicide attackers from Saudi Arabia. Now, why is that relevant, that 34 of them are from Saudi Arabia? Could it have something to do with the fact that it's the Saudi, I mean, this is where it started, right, Saudi Arabia? It's really where it all started, with Osama bin Laden. We keep coming back to this. Is this about radical Islam, or is this about people just saying, "No, we really don't want to be. We really don't want to be occupied anymore. Thank you very much. You know, it's time to get over it. We don't want to be occupied." And increasingly, it seems that that's simply the case. 34 Saudis, 12 Moroccans. 4 people from Turkey, 3 people from Yemen. Now, what do these countries have in common? What's significant about all of these? Well, as Robert Pape points out in the New York Times, the overwhelming majority of attackers are citizens of Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf countries in which the United States has stationed combat troops since 1990. What we're seeing here is the fruit of George Bush the Elder, the George Bush Senior's Gulf War strategy that involved placing American troops in the Middle East so that we could evict Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. He says, of the other suicide terrorists, most came from America's closest allies in the Muslim world, Turkey, Egypt, Pakistan, Indonesia, and Morocco, rather than from those the State Department considers state sponsors of terror, like Iran, Libya, Sudan, and Iraq. None of them were from those countries. So, you know, what's wrong with this picture? We've got a bunch of countries that we call state sponsors of terrorism. None of those countries are producing terrorists. We have a bunch of countries that we call allies. Turkey, Egypt, Pakistan, Indonesia, Morocco, Saudi Arabia. And those countries are producing suicide bombers. When he goes through and he goes through and he breaks down their strategy, he evaluates their internal communications. He talks about, you know, how are they talking to each other about these things? What is the internal discussion inside Al-Qaeda? Why are these people doing this? Why are they showing up? And what he gets over and over and over again is their ultimate aim, causing America and its allies to withdraw forces from the Muslim world. Pure and simple. Pure and simple. What were Americans willing to die for in 1776? To get the British occupiers to leave. What were Indians willing to die for in the late 19th century, early 20th century? To get the British to leave. What were the Pakistanis willing to die for? First to get the British to leave and then to get the Indians to leave. I mean, pick your country. What were the Vietnamese willing to die for? To get the French to leave and then to get the Americans to leave. What were the Chinese willing to die for? To get the Japanese to leave. What were the Ugandans willing to die? To get the British to leave. 1954. This guy deconstructed the whole thing, and it turns out that none of the official state sponsors of terrorism are producing terrorists. Iran, Libya, Sudan, and Iraq, they're not producing suicide bombers, at least who are participating in killing Americans outside their own countries. And the countries that are producing the suicide bombers, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, Pakistan, Indonesia, and Morocco, are all countries that we have troops in. Their ultimate aim, causing America and its allies to withdraw forces from the Muslim world. The guy's written a book, by the way, Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. Looks like it might be an interesting read. So what's the answer? Do you do what George Bush says and say, we're not gonna give in, no matter how many times they bomb us, no matter how many times they kill us, we're not gonna pull our troops out? Or do you say, okay guys, we've got it. You don't want us there. We don't really want to be there either. We'll see you later. Now what's the downside to that? Well, they could produce terrorist training camps. But those terrorist training camps are not going to have terrorists who are going to come after us if we're not occupying any of their countries. The biggest downside is we wouldn't be able to get cheap oil. We would have to actually pay them the market price for oil. Now we're getting to the real issue. Now we're getting to, you know, why this is, or at least one dimension of what's really going on.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, oh, okay. Now I get it. So, and here, just another question, just rapidly here before I go to the phone line. My question, are we taking our troops, and is Great Britain taking its troops out of Iraq because we're prepared to say to Saddam Hussein, to Osama bin Laden, excuse me, see, Bush has me doing it. And I know this stuff, and Bush has me doing it. Are we pulling our troops out of Iraq because it's the right thing to do? because there's no reason for us to be there because the Iraqis can control their own country very much. Thank you very much. We don't need this patronizing, oh, they're too stupid mentality. They aren't. They're adults. They're grown up. They know how to run a country. They've done it before. They can do it again. Or are we pulling our troops out of Iraq because we're going to need them in Iran? The Mail on Sunday newspaper, a British newspaper, published a leaked British memo this weekend saying that Washington is discussing plans to cut its force from nearly 140,000 to just 66,000 by the middle of the next year, and Britain is going to drop their forces in Iraq from 8,500 to 3,000. The memo said, emerging U.S. plans assume 14 out of 18 provinces could be handed over to Iraqi control by early next year. And then it goes on, there is, however, a debate between the Pentagon and CENTCOM, who favor a relatively bold reduction in force numbers, and the multinational force in Iraq, whose approach is more cautious. I'm telling you, as long as we have anybody left in Iraq, those soldiers are going to be at risk. They're absolutely going to be at risk. Harriet in Seattle's on the line with a Leonard Clark update. Hey, Harriet, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just went to the Leonard Clark website, and there is that brief comment about, you know, the site's down, he's been arrested, et cetera, et cetera. And they said since that site was being watched, go to the guy's other blog, who's the one that was putting up Leonard's webpage. And that's no www, it's just Spidel, S-P-I-D as in David, EL.net/blog. And the update is that, I was reading this update here, and apparently Leonard had requested that Kevin back up all of the information. So it's all been archived. He says here, the rest of this, none of the comments and or posts have been permanently deleted. I have them all. So it does exist, and I don't know what he's going to do with it in the way of an archive.
He has them until Alberto Gonzalez sends the goons in to get him.
Yeah, probably so. And so that's something to follow on this blog. It's an excellent one. There's also another thing, if you have 2 seconds, I'll mention.
Literally 2 seconds.
Oh, good. I'll make it quick. A gal talking about her son-in-law. Oh, well, you have the music. This can wait.
We have 10 seconds.
Oh, okay. That the guys over in Iraq are being pressured around the clock to reenlist or face stop loss.
Wow. And yeah, well, surprise, surprise.
Yep.
Thanks a lot, Harriet, for the
okay.
report. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our number 1-866-889-8894. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Our program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices. Their telephone number, give them a call now, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, 511-MACS. And Macintosh PC, if it's computer, they can do it, they have it, they can help. They're a great resource. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Listen, I heard you say about the guy getting arrested because he was in the service and he ran for Senate or Congress.
Well, what he did was he put up a blog. His name, Leonard Clark was his name, and he put up a blog in which he was criticizing Bush. In fact, he called for Bush's impeachment on July 1st because apparently he saw friends of his killed and he around him in Iraq, and he just felt like, this is senseless. Why are we here? What are we doing this for? Just so Bush can get political capital, which is why George Bush, it turns out, back in 99, said he was going to invade Iraq, was because it would give him enough political capital that his party could take complete control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And he was right. And anyhow, so Leonard Clark says, this is wrong. This guy should be impeached for lying us into a war. And then he said, you know, when he gets back home, he intends to get involved in politics, maybe even running for the Senate. And it was not a campaign speech that he was giving. He just made that as an offhand comment. And so the military has used that as an excuse, apparently, according to our report from Harriet and the blog, to arrest him for engaging in campaign activity while in uniform.
Okay, let me tell you what happened in our area in Allegheny County, which encompasses, you know, Pittsburgh and that.
Sure.
We had a man went into the National Guard, John Pippi. He ran for Senate, and he was told he wasn't allowed because he was in the service. Guess who came in? Attorney General Ashcroft, and waived that.
You're so, kidding.
No, and he won. You can look it up. Senator John Pippi, P-I-P-P-Y. He's from the Robinson Township area. And the Attorney General came in, and, you know, he waived that law or ruling,
yeah.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's but, part know, of the Uniform Code of Military
yeah,
Justice.
Are we living under two forms of government? In it? Well, maybe three, counting, you know, Tony Blair from England.
Yeah.
You know, he's our third president, I believe. But, you know what, I would like to also make a comment about when I hit up on the Caspian Sea in Halliburton,
sure,
the
Jim.
Pipeline. I saw a famous saying that, boy, if you look at it now, it says, if you can scare the people about a tax, and then when they complain about it, attack their patriotism. Guess who said it?
It was Goebbels.
Joe Goebbels, yep, right.
Yeah.
The propagandist for Adolf Hitler.
Yep.
Now, if that isn't what this administration is doing, scaring the people, and then put their flags on their lapels, made in China, and then attack the people that want to have the democracy, because we're losing too much of our democracy to these people.
Yeah, I agree.
And I thank you for your time, but if you
You're
want
welcome.
To look that up, you look that up. That guy's in office right now. He's Pennsylvania State Senator.
I'll take
John
your word for it.
Pippi.
I'll take
thank
your word for
you,
it. Jim, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to us there on WPTT in Pittsburgh. Amazing. John Ashcroft gives a waiver to a guy who wants to run for the Senate. Here you've got a guy, Leonard Clark, leonardclark.com/blog. Leonard Clark, who is over in Iraq, one of our soldiers serving in Iraq, member of the National Guard, I believe, serving in Iraq, and he simply mentions in an offhand way on his blog that when he comes back, he might think about running for the United States Senate because he's so upset about what has happened, about the breakdown of the political process in the United States, about how our politics has been so corrupted, our politics has been taken over by madmen, that he wants to get involved in politics when he comes home. And bang, they looking for an excuse to arrest this guy because he's on his blog telling the truth about what's going on in Iraq. And so they arrest him for attempting to run for political office. It is just absolutely mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. It's a shame. I don't know. Well, you can call your member of Congress and say, you know, which you can reach at 1-877-SOB-USOB and say, would you please look into what's going on with this noble soldier in Iraq, Leonard Clark, leonardclark.com, and what you can do to help him. That would be a good start. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you 27 minutes before the hour, or 33 and a half after. As you may choose, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, tomhartman.com, the website if you want to drop into the most fascinating, interesting, active, alive, full of fun, interesting, strange, occasionally sexy and weird people on the entire internet. Yes, indeed, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. It'll drop you in there. In the meantime, you can also call the station, 1-866-889-8894. Toll-free across the United States. Kate in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Kate, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I had a couple of thoughts I wanted to run by you.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that even though this administration seems to be really incompetent, I think they're really actually sophisticated in their understanding of human nature. And the reason I say that is because Bush is getting low ratings all across the country for the war and the economy, et cetera, but he still gets high ratings for fighting terror.
Right.
So when I ask myself, why aren't they really protecting the so-called homeland, when you look at all the, you know, things that they're not protecting, the answer to me is because they don't have to, because terror attacks actually keep them in power, and they know that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say that, and it's like right up on the edge of conspiracy theory,
mm-hmm.
and yet I can tell you the best thing that could happen to George W. Bush would be for there to be another terror attack in the United States.
And exactly.
It's a tragedy to even think that way. But
it really defies logic. But when you look back at how to manipulate people, it makes total sense.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for somehow those of us who are, I guess, can perceive that, to start talking about the fact that terror is not, start somehow undermining the perception that he's fighting terror successfully. And I don't quite know how to do that, but there's something.
Well, you can just point out the reality of what's going on. They're still not checking the cargo on airplanes, although we're spending more than the FBI spends on its entire annual budget to search Granny at the airport. We're still not checking the cargo on airplanes. We're only checking 2-3% of the cargo that's coming into our ports. Our southern border with Mexico is so porous that 1 million to 2 million people a year are coming across it without our knowing who they are or why they're coming. Our chemical factories, almost 100 of which are located in communities where over 1 million people could die if they went down, are not being protected because Bush has said, no, let's make a voluntary. Let's let industry pay for that. Our rail system is not protected. Our buses are not protected. Our industrial infrastructure is being given away to the Chinese. Whether or not that has to do with terrorism, it's not protecting the so-called homeland. And then you've got nuclear power plants. We have over 100 nuclear power plants in this country that have cooling pools next to them. And yes, if you take a Cessna 150 and fly it into the dome of the reactor, it'll bounce off. It might cause some damage, but it's not going to blow up the reactor. But the reality is that in most of these cooling pools, there's more radioactive stuff that is still fissionable. It still can explode. There's more nuclear stuff sitting in these cooling pools than there is inside the dome. And there's nothing over them. In some cases, there's a piece of canvas over them. Mohammed Atta was going to attack the Indian Point nuclear power plant. That was his original plan. He was going to dive a suicide plane into the reactor there, or into the cooling pool next to it. And he abandoned that idea because he assumed that because that would doing that would sterilize a 100-mile radius around it, which would include all of New York City. He assumed that there must be surface-to-air missiles and that he would get shot down before he had a chance to hit the nuclear power plant. He didn't realize that he was wrong. There aren't, to this day, there's no surface-to-air missiles there. And people are going, oh my God, he's telling the terrorists what to do. No, I'm sorry. I learned this by reading it in the New York Times.
Well, Tom, I think you're such a great articulate voice about how Bush is not actually fighting terror that I would love to see you write another article about it for Common Dreams so that we can all have those facts at our fingertips and start using them in letters to the editors, things like that.
Thanks, Kate. I need to get on it. I appreciate it. And thank you for calling. It's good to hear from you. In fact, you know, Kate raised a fascinating point, and that is the so-called homeland. Can anybody remember the word homeland being used in the United States before George Bush started using it after 9/11? Think back. I remember how weird it sounded to me, and I think it sounded weird, probably weirder to me than to most Americans, when I first heard Bush use the word homeland, because it was a word that had never been used before. We never discussed the American homeland, because homeland is a word that traditionally is tied to a race. Homeland was the word that the Zionists in Europe were using in the 19-teens and 20s. They wanted there to be a Jewish homeland. Homeland is the word that Native Americans use to talk about their wanting their land back, their homeland. And Adolf Hitler, Germany had traditionally been referred to as not as the homeland of Germany, but Germany had traditionally been referred to as the fatherland, Der Vaterland. This is Der Vaterland, the fatherland. And Adolf Hitler was a very, you know, a student. He and Rudolf Hess, who they, you know, they collaboratively wrote Mein Kampf while Hitler was in prison back in the late 20s there. And Hitler was a student of Zionism. He was fascinated by Zionism. He was obsessed with Zionism. I mean, you know, on the one hand, he saw the Jews as a threat. On the other hand, he wanted to emulate them. And he thought that if he could cause the German people to think of themselves as a race, even though they look very much like the French people next door and the Italian people to the south and the Swedish people to the north, I mean, there are blonde-haired Germans, there's brown-haired Germans, there's all, you know, if he could cause them to think of themselves as a unique race, even though it's just the two things that hold them together are geography and language, but if he could cause them to think of themselves as a race, then he could create a loyalty among them that would be absolutely unbeatable. People would do things. And so he was trying to recreate the whole idea in Germany that he saw the Zionist movement doing about there being an Israel. This, is, of course, was before there was Israel. And in 1934, at the Nuremberg rally, Rudolf Hess got up in introducing Adolf Hitler and said, "Now, for the first time, I introduce to you the man who is creating a homeland, Heimat, a homeland for all Germans, for alles Deutsche, all Germans all over the world, alles über die ganze Welt, a homeland, a Heimat for all Germans all over the world, this man is creating." This is, I mean, right out of the literature of Zionism, Hitler trying to create this. And the word homeland, in as far as I can tell, outside of literally people like, you know, the gypsies who you know, talking about they want to go back to their homeland, or Albanians saying that, you know, in the Albanian diaspora, or Jews in the Jewish diaspora, outside of people who have been displaced, nobody talks about homeland. Hitler began talking about homeland. Rudolf Hess introducing Adolf Hitler in 1934, the first time the word homeland was used in a big way by the Nazis. A word that had not been used before. He didn't say der Vaterland, he said Heimat. Heimat, Susan. The Heimat, the homeland for us and for Germans. For alles Deutsche, alles über die ganze Welt, for all the Germans, all, here it is.
Dank ihrer Führung,
thanks to the Führer,
wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen, Heimat zu sein. Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt. Adolf Hitler, Sieg Hitler! Sieg Hitler! Sieg Hitler!
There you go. Rudolf Hess introducing the word homeland to the German people. Rudolf Hess introducing the word homeland to the German people. It just gives me creeps every time I hear the word homeland here. Because America is not a racially homogenous group. You know, we always used to refer to it as domestic security, national security, American security. And Bush came along, and it's almost like they're reading the playbook. It's downright spooky. The other thing that Hitler did was he believed that you had to have a national religion if you were going to have a powerful national state. You had to have a national mythos, you had to have a national homeland, and you had to have a national religion. And so Hitler appointed he merged church and state. And he appointed a Reichsbishop. Bishop Müller was the Reichsbishop. He committed suicide at the end of the war. A Lutheran minister. And made him the head bishop for all of Germany. And you just have to consider the power of religion. Well, now here we have the Protestants in the United States. It's as was posted over on the, I believe this is from the Think Progress blog. Fred Phelps, head of the Westboro Baptist Church, isn't content with just celebrating hate crimes or the death of American soldiers. The group has now posted a press release in response to yesterday's horrific attacks in London. This is, of course, from last Friday. Fred Phelps, he says, thank God for the bombing on London subway today, July 7th, 2005, wherein dozens were killed and hundreds severely injured. Wish it were many more. And he quotes from Jeremiah. Thou shalt say unto them, this is a nation that obeyed not the Lord, the voice of the Lord their God, nor receives correction. Truth is perished, and it is cut off from their mouth. Jeremiah 7:28. And then underneath that it says, England, island of the sodomite damned. You see, England, what drew Fred Phelps' ire is that the British Army openly welcomes gays. The British Navy openly welcomes gays. The British Air Force, if you're gay, they'd love you to sign up. And so Fred Phelps, you know, they have a picture of the Queen. It says, Queen of Fags. Tony Blair, Antichrist fag. The British flag, it says fag flag. When is the F word, this particular F word, fag, when is that going to become like the N word? I mean, I don't understand. It's not appropriate to use a slur against one group but not another. And then they say, Fred Phelps and his buddies, Tony Blair and his bitch barrister wife, what? These two have led England to irreversible doom, pushing the fag agenda. This from this church. It is now a crime, they say, to preach God's truth about fags in England. Blair wants to be president, antichrist of EU, European Union, whose laws also criminalize gospel preaching. They do. What you're seeing here is the absolute logical and predictable consequence of a media that raises up high and gives credibility to people like Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. These are people who, if Jesus showed up, would supervise his trial and sentence him to death. There's no doubt in my mind. Just like in Dostoevsky's novel, Karamazov. Thank you, Scott. The Brothers Karamazov. There's that chapter, I think it's chapter 5. About the Grand Inquisitor, where Jesus shows up and he's confronted by the head of the Catholic Church. He's not the Pope. The Pope is off someplace, but this guy is like the head bishop. And he sentences him to death for heresy. And here, Jerry Falwell.
Man, I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
He's talking about 9/11. This was broadcast the day after 9/11, 2 days after, 9/13. And then, of course, Pat Robertson has to answer.
Well, I totally concur, and the problem is we have adopted that agenda at the highest levels of our government, and so we're responsible as a free society for what the top people do, and the top people, of course, the court system.
Oh, the court system. Oh, go after the judges here again.
What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if, in fact, God continues to lift the curtain and allow...
Continues to?
...the enemies of America... to give us probably what we deserve.
We deserved it, Jerry? We deserved 9/11? Jerry Falwell telling us we deserved 9/11. And I wonder where the Bushies are on that one.
Yeah, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the...
Pat Robertson agrees.
...to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
Do you get this? I mean, this is just... And these guys are like on national media all the time. Pat Robertson ran for president as a Republican. Jerry Falwell started the Moral Majority. Speaking as a Christian, as somebody who was raised in the Methodist Church, and speaking as a Christian myself, I am offended that radical loonies like this in the church of my upbringing are running around saying things like this and bringing disrepute to my religion. I mean, this is horrifying. And then coming out and saying, oh yeah, what happened in London, good thing. Yes, Fred Phelps. Thanks a lot, Fred. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now I can understand why you were hot, 'cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame, tried to tell us it was all the same. But now the years roll by and our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. And those WMD you promised on TV, hey, admit it, you figured it wrong. So I'm taking my country back.
There you go. Yeah, time to take America back from the crazies who have snatched it. You know, it's Alawi, Ayad Alawi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, saying,
now you don't know my name, but you know who I am. I'm your everyday work hard, play hard, raise kids and pray hard, common man.
There you go, and he's taking his country back. I love it. And that's what we have to do. That's what we absolutely have to do, my friends, is take our country back. Elaine in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Elaine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just heard the story about that soldier being arrested.
Yes, Leonard Clark.
I was so angry about that I got on the phone to Senator McCain's office and asked them to look into that. So I'm wondering what
good
they'll
on
do.
You.
I can't imagine, this young man is out there, and I'm sure he saw a lot of terrible things, and plus his buddy's being killed from what you said.
Yeah.
And then, now he's saying he wants to serve the country as a representative or a congressman or whatever he's gonna run for. So then they arrest him?
That's right.
I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, I don't understand why they'd out a CIA agent either. It's called revenge. This is one of the favorite pastimes of the Bush administration.
We have so many big problems in this country.
I know.
I mean,
and they want to distract us from
guy?
It. Well, they, you know, we have some really huge problems, and that's why they talk about gay marriage. That's why they talk about flag burning, because they don't want us talking about the real problems.
They'll probably get after me for calling Senator McCain.
Hopefully not, Elaine, but they have the authority now. They can sneak into your house without a warrant now. You know, the Patriot Act allows that.
Yeah, I said that I'm a history buff, and I think the forefathers have to be turning over in their graves.
I agree with you. Elaine, well, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for listening there on WPTT in Pittsburgh. I do appreciate it. Yeah, the forefathers, I am sure, are looking down and going, This isn't what the idea that we had. Sorry. Oh, it's a tragedy. We must get politically active. Show up at the polls in 2006. But between now and then, contribute money to the political parties. Get involved. Show up at whatever party. Republican Party, Democratic Party, Green Party, Progressive Party. Get involved. Yes, we need good Republicans to even take back the Republican Party. I'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.